Moin und herzlich willkommen bei einer neuen Folge von Finance Forward. Heute sprechen wir mit dem Klarna-Gründer Sebastian Siemiatkowski über die Anfänge von seinem Fintech und über den krassen Bewertungsabsturz von 45,6 Milliarden auf 6,7 Milliarden Dollar. Außerdem geht es um die Frage, wie man mit künstlicher Intelligenz Personal einsparen kann. Das Interview hat mein Kollege Kaspar Schlenk gemeinsam mit dem UMR-Gründer Philipp Westermeier geführt. Viel Spaß damit!
Hi Sebastian, how did you find the idea for Klarna?
Erst vielen Dank und es tut mir sehr leid, ich mache das nicht in Deutsch.
You could, you
sehr
could.
Sehr schlecht.
Did you learn it at school?
Ich habe einen Sommer gearbeitet in Bayern. In Oberfranken, in einem Bau. Milke Kühe und alles gemacht.
Ja. When was that?
Ich war vielleicht, wann ich war, 15 Jahre alt oder so.
Ja. Krass.
Und dann habe ich auch gearbeitet in St. Moritz, in the Kempinski Hotel, as a bar waiter. Mm-hmm. Aber da war es more Swiss-Dutsch, than Fränkisch.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, like my German is, but I understand well. I feel so embarrassed when I speak. So
I mean, it's not that long ago. How old are you today?
I'm 42.
Okay.
So it's not horrible long time ago, no.
Okay, but I mean, give me a little bit about the beginnings. How did it all start? I mean, Klarna, I just tried to say that, is a model that you don't find that if you sit on your couch and think about a startup idea, you don't come up with like, okay, let's do this Klarna
model. That's true. No, I think actually it had a little bit to do with that Kempinski, St. Moritz time because... after we did that, me and my later-to-be co-founder decided to go around the world without flying, which was a fantastic adventure. And when we come back, I was too late to continue my studies at the Stockholm School of Economics. And so I had another year, a gap year, that I just had to fill with something. And I was just desperately looking for a job back in my hometown of Uppsala. And then I found myself working in this company as a salesperson that were offering factoring debt collection services. So basically Rechnungsverkauf, etc. Right. And so it was kind of the last place in the world that I ever expected to work. But, you know, I tried to make the best out of it. And when I started working there, it was very difficult to sell these services because most customers were not that interested, factoring and things like this. And so I started calling these small e-commerce companies that at this point of time, you have to remember this is 04, 05. Amazon wasn't a big thing in Sweden. So there were tons of like small entrepreneurs that were just realized that you could buy Google AdWords really cheap and sell a lot of stuff, right? And didn't matter what it was really. And they needed services like this, and they were looking at traditional mail order companies, like the Ottos of the world or Wehkamp and all these, and basically concluded that like Rechnungskauf was the traditional way of payment on mail order, but they didn't want to offer it because they were worried that the customers wouldn't pay, that they wouldn't get the money. And so when we came with Rechnungskauf, but 100% risk-free for the merchant. And also we took care about the cash flow and stuff like that. Consumers loved it because this was a traditional way to pay for mail order. And the merchants liked it, right? So that was really the beginning of it.
So in a nutshell, your business model from day one was you took a small percentage of what you sort of like laid out to the merchant while he was waiting for the payment from the customer.
Exactly. So it was actually mostly about like avoiding the administration, because obviously card payments were a lower administration for the merchants because they don't have to send rechnungs and collect the money and all that. But also the risk, obviously, of consumers not paying. And then also to some degree, the cash flow that you had to wait for the money as a merchant, the merchants didn't like. And this were the problems that we saw for the merchant while we gave the consumers kind of the traditional way to pay that they've always used in a mail order setting.
Die Werbung.
Wir machen eine kurze Unterbrechung für unseren Werbepartner Kapital. Seit vielen Jahren zeigt das Wirtschaftsmagazin Kapital Entwicklungen aus der Wirtschafts- und Finanzwelt, begleitet den Wandel von Unternehmen, erkennt neue Trends und erklärt die großen Umbrüche der Weltwirtschaft. Neben Analysen und Tests gibt es unter anderem auch eine umfangreiche Auswahl an Ratgeberthemen. Sichert euch jetzt euer Plus an Wirtschaft und Finanzen. Mit dem Code OMR24 könnt ihr Kapital Plus 3 Monate lang für 99 Cent testen. Einfach auf www.kapital.de/OMR einlösen und alle umfangreichen Ratgeber zu Geldanlage, Vorsorge, Versicherung und Immobilien lesen. Außerdem erhaltet ihr Zugriff auf alle Kolumnen und Analysen der Kapitalexperten. Wir wünschen viel Spaß.
Werbung Ende.
I mean, it sounds like a business model that demands a lot of cash instantly. I mean, you know, it's not something that you would stumble into and then you do it bootstrapped for years because, you know, the more money you lay out, I mean, you have to take it from somewhere.
Yeah, that's funny you say that because I think to some degree, this is why the banks didn't do this. So at the time we started doing this, the banks were only doing factoring or kind of Rechnungskauf. They were doing only for really large invoices. So nobody had done this in a IT digital way and processing tons of small purchases. You remember like our standard transactions, maybe like 100 euro, right? And so a lot of it was just the digitalization of these things. But to your point also then, so we realized already that was solving a lot of problems. But then we realized we didn't have cash, to your point. So we came up with this very great idea. We said to you like, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Merchant, we're going to take over these invoices from you, these Rechnungs. You're going to get paid in 2 weeks. So we actually had a very odd, people were laughing at us a little bit later on in the industry because we had a factoring model where you're supposed to Rechnungskauf, but we didn't actually pay for the invoices after the consumer had paid. So we still created a positive cash flow for ourselves, despite the fact that it was a factoring model, which is a little bit odd. That's not how it works today anymore. But you as an entrepreneur, you just have to find find a way that works, right? So,
what was the reason that the merchants accepted that in this case?
I think to some degree, to be fair, some of them didn't really think about it much. They were just like, oh, this is nice. Somebody takes the risk and somebody takes the administration. And they didn't think too much about the cash flow, right? I think that's a typical issue for all entrepreneurs. We don't think about cash flow much initially. So I think they they didn't consider it much. And then over time, like after a few years, we figured out a way to start getting banks to borrow us money so that we could borrow the money and so forth. So we solved that. But initially, actually, they cared more about not having the risk of customers not paying. And they cared more about the avoiding all the administration, right? That was the big thing. It wasn't really the cash flow for a lot of these companies.
So then in the early years, the huge wave of e-commerce companies coming out, they carried you to a certain size. I mean, there were so many companies, shifting their model online, starting a shop, basically. And that was your target group. That was your customers that you were after.
Yes, very much so. And I mean, that was also what was we were very spoiled with that, right? Because we would sign a company like Nelly, for example, or Webhallen, these two typical examples in Sweden, which at that point in time were very small kind of e-commerce websites, maybe revenue of like 1 million euros or even 500,000 euros a year. But they were growing so fast, right? Like they were growing tremendously fast. And so once we had them signed up and they started using our services, we were kind of double growing because we both had the growth of our customers and we get paid per transaction. And in addition to that, we were adding more merchants ourselves, right? So this was helping us to very quickly to grow fairly quickly, considering we were only really active in Sweden to start with and then some other Nordic markets. And I think it wasn't until 8 or 9 that we came into Germany.
And how is your financing history? I mean, when did you do the first major fundraising?
So there's some good learnings for other entrepreneurs there, because when we started a company, we were three three guys with business background, right? So none of us could actually code or write engineering code. And so we realized we need to build a system. And our business angel that we found, she was amazing, Jane. She decided that she was going to invest 60,000 euros. We asked for 40,000 euros, but she said, we're going to need 60,000 euros. And she wanted 10% of the company. And that was basically just for a PowerPoint slide. So I think that was a fairly nice valuation at that point of time for a PowerPoint slide. But then she said, I know these engineers and they are great and they can code, but they will want equity in return for coding. So they took 37% of the equity for coding. And that was a little bit, it was good. They were amazing. And they built, you know, in 4 months, what to some degree is the foundation of the system we have today. So they were really, really great. However, we didn't really talk about expectations, which I think is a mistake. Mm-hmm. And as much as I wanted them to continue and be kind of co-founders of the business and continue working, after 6 months, they were like, oh, we built the system now, we got the equity, and we're going to move on and do something else. And at that point in time, there was a famous quote in the board, Klarna will never be so big that it's going to need five engineers of this capacity. So they're like, you know, so they moved on, which was a big frustration to me, but also very, very difficult because I had no experience of coding. And now I needed to hire somebody that could code and evaluate their work and be able to challenge them on their work. And I just didn't know how to do it. So it took us a few years to figure out, you know, how to get great engineering culture and great engineers on board. And it wasn't really until Sequoia invested in 2009, so about 4 years in, that we got an investor who really understood technology and who could help us kind of push the company in that direction.
But at that point, half the company was already gone. I mean, 37% to the engineers, 10% to the lady that gave you the 60,000. So, yep. There was not even a business that you were three founders. And then Sequoia came and you only owned like what, 15% of the company?
Yes, I owned. So I started off after the first funding round, I had 17%. But what we were fortunate about was that we were bootstrapping. So actually, we at the worst time, I think we were negative 30,000 euros of that 60,000 euros that we raised. And then we started getting a profit. So we were actually profitable already the second year. And we were profitable for the first 12 years of existence, right? So the point is that if you look at those early press releases of Klarna financing rounds, it looks like people are investing money, but actually most of it is secondary. Klarna raised extremely little and was extremely cash or kind of equity efficient for the first up until 2017 and 18. And so that meant that I sold some shares over the years and I got diluted, obviously, in some funding rounds. But I was still, you know, a fairly large shareholder. I'm now down at like 6-7%. But the fact is that, like, I started off at 17. So if I would have made a better deal with those engineers, I would have been a much larger shareholder today. But, so like it was the first round. And then after that, we have been very, very little diluted, actually.
It must have been some very lucrative engineering by those guys.
Indeed. However, they were unfortunate, but I think maybe a little bit fair, but they actually sold very, very early. So they lost on all the upside. So I think maybe life is a little bit fair in that sense.
So fast forward to today, what's the last public valuation?
The last one was the 6.5 billion that we did in, after the major drop in fintech prices, right? So we were officially valued at 45, and then came the happy days when everything dropped and, you know, investor sentiment went away. So then we did a round at 6.5.
So I mean that's something to digest. 45 billion was a real accepted valuation a couple of years ago, which is crazy. I mean, that would have been like one of the most valuable German companies across the board. I mean, including all DAX companies here in Germany. 45 billion is super big. Were you like believing in that valuation at the time?
Well, yeah, it's a funny story. I feel that question is a little bit similar to asking a football player, you know, did you expect to play Champions League? I think that, like, nobody, at least I believe that no entrepreneur, I mean, I would not have been doing what I was doing if I didn't aspire to be playing in Champions League. Like, so ever since I started a company, my aspiration has been to build a 100 billion or even a trillion dollar type of company like Apple or Google or whatever. And so that doesn't mean that I have been convinced that it's going to happen. That's a very different thing, right? Like, but obviously I've had to have the aspiration, the ambition, right? So for me, when valuation started, you know, increasing very quickly. So we were, you know, we first got, when Sequoia invested, we were $100 million. They bought 25% then. That was in 2009. In 2010, we got a unicorn status, $1 billion. But then, because we were struggling a little bit in Germany and we had like issues and stuff, we actually kind of plateaued a little bit. So went from 1 to 2 billion in 15. So we were kind of flat there for a while. And then...
flat is a good word for doubling, yeah.
And then, again, it comes back to ambition, right? And better. But then in 17, when US and UK started actually happening, we went from, you know, 5 to, I think in 18 or 19, we got 5. In 20, we got 10. In 21, we got 30. And then, you know, at the very end, we had a primary at 45. So I think that, like, the point is obviously, even to me, two things, right? Like, one, I understood that the multiples were different. It wasn't like we were growing the company from, you know, 5, 10. Like, if you take it like 5 in 19 to 45 3 years later, it's not like the company was, you know, almost 10 times larger or 10 times more profitable, right? So obviously the multiples were different. The expectations were much, much bigger part of the valuation than they had been previously. And kind of the belief that the future would be amazing. But on the other hand, also with that said, I feel like, you know, if you look at our industry, the credit card industry or the banking industry, it's a $1 trillion industry. And if you do really disrupt this industry and take a massive market share, it is not unthinkable that a company could be worth $100 billion or even $1 trillion. Like, it's not unthinkable, right? It's a lot of work. It's very difficult to get there, but it can happen. And that's still why I'm here. So I've said to Masa and SoftBank, who was the guy who invested at the highest evaluation, I'm like, I'm as committed to make sure that he makes a lot of money on his investment that I am to all the other shareholders that invested at different prices. And I am still here because I think it's still possible to do that.
So looking back, was it a mistake to take so much money and to get away from this profitable path that you were on? Because right now, profitability is so much worth.
Yes and no. Like, I think there's always, I think you would be dishonest or incompetent if you do not, you know, recognize that when you do things, you do mistakes and you try to recognize what they were and what to learn from them. So obviously there were mistakes done, but I think one has to remember two things that are critical to this. In 18 and 19, when we were still 5 billion, we were predominantly a Nordic/DACH region company with a growing presence in the UK. At this point of time, the market in the US opened up. And my aspiration and belief was always, if we're going to build a truly global company, I have to make it in the US. We have to make it in the US. It was like, to me, always, the, you know, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere, right? So when that opportunity opens up, go all in, right? Just go all in. And then we were lucky that this happened to coincide with this rise in valuations that you saw in the market. So it allowed us a lot of money, you could say cheap money, to be able to invest heavily in the US, right? So 18, I think, was the last year we showed the profit. And then 19, we started investing so heavily that we were loss-making, right? And to some degree, from 19 to 23, we have gone from zero existence in the US to being a very large player in the US market, but at the same point of time, with a huge potential to continue growing. I think we did, you know, we did a few hundred million dollars of gross profit in the US in the last quarter. So the point is that, like, that in itself, I think, is a fantastic achievement. And it's going to, for the long-term company and for the long-term shareholder value, be very, very valuable that we did that. And we took that money, we took that opportunity. And also you have to remember that, like, we then reached a burn rate of, you know, at the most extreme month, we had a negative EBITDA of $150 million or about 150 million euros, right?
So in a month. That's
in a month.
Whoa.
So that was a fairly, you know, ambitious investment strategy. And I think, you know, at that point of time, is every $1 million spent super wisely? You know, like, no, of course not.
What did you spend all the money on? I mean, losing 150 million a month with a software business model. I mean, you're not like loading your warehouses. Where did all the money go?
So, I mean, it was predominantly two things, right? It was predominantly marketing, writing, you know, marketing or marketing investments to grow the company faster. And then the second one was obviously software development and product teams building new features and new services, right? So these are the two major things. But also one thing you have to, which is critical to recognize, is that when Klarna goes into a new market, underwriting credit at the very beginning is difficult because you have only new customers and you have no returning customers. And so the risks is much higher. And so we were actually losing money on every transaction in the US. And because the US was starting to grow so fast and becoming so large and so big as a part of Klarna, if you have negative gross margin on every transaction, it massively pushes your gross profit down. And this was the effect that we've seen. And we had the same thing in Germany. We had the same thing in Finland. You know, we had the same thing in every market we started. You have this first negative curve before you get, you know, the kind of steep curve up. And this was the case in the US as well. So it was the combination of investing heavily and this early phase in the US in a massive market where we were losing a lot of money. So I think that, like, but again, you know, $150 million is a lot. But you have to remember one thing, right, which I think is critical. At that point of time, at that rate of loss or investments, whatever you want to call it, the point is we needed to raise about $1 billion a year to sustain that, right? And the point is, if you're valued $45 to $50 billion, that is only 2% dilution on an annual basis, right? So actually, if you think about that, like 2% dilution because you're trying to achieve $1 trillion outcome or $100 billion outcome is not that crazy. So the point is that, like, you people forget that it's in that perspective, right? Now, again, I'm not trying to defend that, like, every decision was wise and we could have done it smarter and better. I'm sure there were things that we could have done better. But I think it should still be put in perspective, right?
Okay.
How hard was it to change the strategy to, get again profitable with the layoffs and to restructure the company in a way?
It was difficult emotionally because I think that's the one thing that I maybe regret the most, is that when we were building so fast and we were investing so heavily, you know, we thought it made sense for the shareholders, for the company, for the customers, for the employees. What we didn't predict was that the investor sentiment, so like investors' beliefs in companies like this, if it shifts that fast, what will be the consequences for employees? And I think that, like, that was something that I regret a little bit, that, like, maybe we should have thought to ourselves as we came, you know, at the end of 2021, you know, what if market changes? Should we really continue hiring at this pace so fast and so forth, right? Because what ended up happening is we hired some people at the beginning of 2022 that we had to ask to leave already a few months later. And that, I feel, you know, I would have liked to avoid, right? So I think that was a mistake that I regret. But on the other parts, the interesting thing is that reducing our costs, so basically reducing our investments rate and it consequentially having to ask some people to leave, that was only 20-25% of the return to profitability. The big effect of getting return to profitability was something that I knew and I could feel very comfortable about, which was I had seen this curve in Germany, in the UK, in every market we've gone into. At the beginning, we lose money per transaction. We have to adopt and understand their local fraud, the local credit underwriting. We get more and more returning customers. And then when you turn that corner and you go around from losing money per transaction to actually making money per transaction, then you get this hockey stick curve of profitability that just goes through the roof. And I had seen this on so many markets and so many occasions. So obviously I felt very comfortable that, like, if we slow down growth a little bit in the US, if we focus on the profitability per transaction, we're going to see this massive swing. And that was 60, 70% of the return to profitability came from, you know, making US from loss-making to profit-making. And ironically, which is very interesting, ironically, if we would have cut growth to US to zero, it would have been much harder to get back to profitability because we needed growth and profitability to get back, if you see what I mean. Like, it would just, because the size wasn't big enough yet. So it was difficult, but, and the team did an amazing job to turn it around. So only 12 months, May 2022, we booked minus $150 million or euros equivalent, right, in EBITDA. But 12 months later, we booked a profit, right? So it took 12 months to turn that around, which I think is pretty amazing.
And is the US your biggest market now?
It's actually our biggest market now, yes. By revenue, is our biggest market. Germany is still larger by volume. You know, so it's basically Germany's the largest market, US second largest, and then, you know, I think it's UK and then Sweden and so forth, right? So, yeah.
Did you ever do acquisitions along the way?
We did some acquisitions. We have done BillPay in Germany a few years back, which was a great acquisition. We've done Sofort, which was a fantastic acquisition that we did very early on. I'm very happy about that one. So we've done some good acquisitions. We've done another great acquisition in Germany, a company called Stocard. I would actually say our best acquisitions have been German for whatever reason. Not sure why that is, but like, and then we've done a few others. But that was part of what we were trying to do when we recognized that valuations were very high. We obviously used our stock as a currency to make some acquisitions. I think there maybe the learning would have been, it would have been smarter to buy companies. Like, I think PriceRunner, Stocard, BillPay, and so forth were good acquisitions because they had revenue. When we bought like more startups with great technology, but didn't actually have a functioning revenue models, those were probably less of great decisions, right? So it would have been smarter to acquire more revenue using that, right?
How much funds did you raise along the way? I mean, what's the total funding that Klarna did?
That's a good question. I think, you know, the ironic thing is I'm a little bit frustrated about that because I was always like one of the best at not raising funds, as I said previously, not do primaries, be profitable and only do secondaries. Uh-huh. But then you get a little bit like, you know, what is it called when you drive on the highway and you don't see the speed anymore, right? Like, so when we were in those heydays, we raised a lot of money. So I think actually the total amount now is about 5 billion or something, right? Which means that like on total, being valued 6.5 and raised 5 isn't that impressive. But I think that like, again, I think that I feel very comfortable that we will be able to, if you give us just one or two more years, the story will look much more attractive.
I mean, also it's a function of interest rates, right? I mean, your business is heavily impacted by interest rates, not only because the valuation itself of a digital company or a tech company is impacted, but I mean, it's also baked into your business model, right?
It is to some degree, but it's slightly less than people would recognize. And the reason for that is that we are not lending the money for a long period of time. So if you think about it, like a bank in general would borrow my money, maybe the average duration of a loan, maybe 2 years or 3 years or something, right? In Klarna's case, it's a Rechnung. So, you know, you make a purchase for 100 euros, we borrow that for 30 days, and then the money comes back. And then we borrow out the same money again. And we can actually borrow out the same money 12 times a year. So the interest rate cost on an annual basis, even if it's 3-4%, isn't going to impact the unit economics that much as it does if you are borrowing out money for a longer period of time. So there is obviously some impact, and we obviously have a higher cost today than we had, you know, at lower interest, but it's not as significant as people would sometimes believe. Mm-hmm.
So talking about Sofort, instant payment is like a really a big trend, global trend right now. You're doing it for a long time. So looking into the future, what kind of role will this play in the payment mix and also for Klarna especially?
Well, I think actually what got me excited about Sofort was...
Maybe to clarify, Sofort is the German word, Sofortüberweisung. I mean, we have this German company that I think is a household name here, Sofort, but I wasn't sure that every listener gets that. I mean, it's Sofortüberweisung. Yeah?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. No, that's right. The thing that excited me about Sofortüberweisung was actually not so much just the instant payment, but it was something else. And I think that is more relevant today than ever before. And it was this concept that was that, like, when I first met Sofort and the founders had left at that point in time, but the people who were running it, it was a Raymond family that owned it. They basically, what was interesting to me was this concept of like, hey, what if I have a digital assistant and I don't want to deal with the bank because the bank has a sucky UI, a poor user experience, these old technology solutions, and the experience is pretty bad. So what if I give my login details, my password and my login, to a digital assistant that logs in on the bank and does a payment or, you know, checks my account for a budget or, you know, whatever it is. Like, so I don't actually have to interact with my bank because my bank isn't that great. So I can interact with a digital assistant instead. And this idea that there could be a digital assistant that could make my life better and I don't have to interact with the bank myself, it just was very fascinating to me already back then. And so that got me excited. It also got the banks in Germany very nervous because they realized the same thing that I realized, which was that if you stop interacting yourself with your bank and instead have your digital assistant interact with the bank, then someday the digital assistant may wake up and say, hey, you know what? Your bank also sucks from a pricing perspective and from the terms they're offering you. I have gone and negotiated better terms with this other bank. Would you mind if I switch for you? And I will do all the paperwork. So don't worry. It's just a click of a button and you're with another bank. And you'll be like, sure, I never interact with this bank anyway. I just interact with you, my digital assistant. So I don't care. Please go ahead and switch, right? So the banks obviously realize like, uh-oh, this is a real threat to the kind of, to their business, right? And this is why the German banks then sued Sofort and started changing the private, they basically said, look, this is a threat for you as a consumer. This is a privacy threat. So they started changing the terms of use, saying you're not allowed to share your credentials with a digital assistant, which is kind of funny because people have been doing that with their private assistant and their mother and their, you know, whatever for a long period of time, but doesn't matter. And then this get up to the EU. This became an EU topic and eventually became the open banking regulation that we have today. So this has been very fascinating to me because this is exactly what I believe where the future is going. Banking is going to become a digital assistant that basically helps you save money, save time, and make sure that you don't pay all of those unnecessary fees that the banks are charging. So that's why Sofort to me has always been so fascinating and kind of intriguing as a company. Sorry for a long answer. Yeah.
Why does it take it so long to envision that vision?
That's a good question. I think the technology wasn't that mature yet, right? So it worked with Sofortüberweisung, worked really well. Most people have a good experience, but it is still kind of clunky. And it's based on macros, right? Like it's almost like at this point of time, the assistant goes to your bank and has a macro. Like, remember how you used to record macros for your old Mac computer where you could like have a macro do something on your behalf, right? That's how it works. And when the bank changes their user experience, you know, still today, an alarm clock goes off in Gießen and an engineer wakes up in the night and fixes the macro so that Sofortüberweisung will continue to work. It's not entirely true, but almost. Because nowadays it's mostly API based. But the point is that like, those technologies were just not entirely mature yet. But what we see now with ChatGPT, with LLMs and OpenAI and all the things that are happening, this vision of a digital assistant that could really create the banking services like they were supposed to work is suddenly in reach, right? It's going to happen in the coming years, for sure.
How much are you in control of your own growth? I mean, growth, I imagine, is a function of signing new shops. I mean, how else can you grow? You can't grow by yourself. I mean, you need some platform to grow on, meaning an online shop. So let's say you signed all the shops that are there. You're then a little dependent on their traction. And right now, e-commerce is not on vogue. People, it's like stable, platooning. Is there any way to kickstart like your growth? Or are you completely dependent on signing new shops? And is your fate a little bit connected to what the shops do?
Yes and no. I think that's definitely been the case. And this is also why we've taken some active choices to remove that dependency, right? And to give a few examples, we launched the Klarna card, which is, by the way, very successful in Germany, among others. Mm-hmm. And that obviously means that the consumers can use Klarna anywhere in a physical store. They don't need to accept Klarna. So the growth then is kind of decoupled from the merchants themselves. That is helpful. Another thing that we've launched that's also doing very well, especially it's been big in the US, is if you download the Klarna app, it has actually an integrated browser. So you can use it just like Safari or Chrome. Mm-hmm. And you can go to any website, Amazon as an example, and you can use Klarna on Amazon, even though Amazon doesn't offer Klarna. So the way that works is we basically issue a virtual one-time card, a Visa card, that we put in the checkout of Amazon, allowing the consumer to pay with Rechnung on Amazon and other websites, basically any website in the world. But in the background, what's happening is actually a Visa card transaction. So the point is that like we found a number of ways to kind of decouple and grow outside of the merchants. But the merchants are still so critical to us, and they are still the main focus of the business. So we are, and we definitely, to your point, when e-commerce has slowed down, we've seen that in our numbers as well, right? Like we do see that it's also impacting our growth for sure. But
would your company double if Amazon would allow Klarna?
Maybe, but to be honest, like I've tried to talk to Amazon so many times.
What do they say? Why don't they accept Klarna?
My suspicion is that they see us as a competitive threat.
Okay. Seriously?
Yes.
Okay.
Because to some degree, what Klarna is trying to do is connecting buyers and sellers more effectively, right? And I think that like if you're a product or a brand, you don't like Amazon because they start shipping some fake products that looks like your brand from a cheaper supplier. You're not in control of how your product is offered or what price, you have limited control over. And Klarna has this idea that like, we want to connect buyers and sellers. We want to make it super simple to buy online, but we don't want to interfere with the presentation of the product. That's why we haven't built a marketplace. We've built a browser where you can go to the actual website of the merchant and you can buy their products in the way they like it. And I think that Amazon to some degree has recognized that if we're very successful with what we're doing, it's not like it's going to take Amazon away, but it's going to slightly reduce the value, right? Like think about it. Like one of the big reasons why Amazon was successful was one-click payments, right? If one-click payments is available everywhere, it takes one reason away for using Amazon. It's not mm-hmm. the only reason because there's two other big reasons, shipping. Mm-hmm. And the third one is the fact that you have all the inventory in the world and you don't have to go to multiple stores to buy, similar, some items. But so, and then also to some degree, I've been frustrated with Amazon because I feel that there's a corporate culture there that I don't really connect to. I feel like there are too many examples of people that feel that they've been run over by that company of that size. And I think that like, I think there is something in the world called karma. And I actually believe that like business has to be beneficial for both sides. And if you like year over year, there was a good example of these German knives, right? This German family company was selling knives mm-hmm. on Amazon. And then suddenly Amazon was producing their own knives at half the cost that looked exactly like that Germany family business. And the point is like, you can do this once or twice, but if you do that over and over again, I just like, I can't connect to that. I don't want to make business with businesses that act that way. Unfortunately, I am at AWS. So that is, you know, is what it is. But like, I just want to see them take that seriously. Like, I think it's critical that you actually, you know, be mindful of your relationships. Like, don't treat them. Like, I love the Japanese car manufacturers and how they have looked at supplier relationships and stuff like that. I just think that there's a different culture. So I'm not a big fan. And maybe Amazon will change this and maybe they will become better at this in the future. But like, this is something that I feel makes me less keen to work together with them, as much as it would be financially probably very attractive.
Is there any other major shop missing on your customer list?
Well, I'm super, super happy after bugging Robert at Zalando for so many years. Poor Robert, he was so tired of me. but finally, we got Zalando on board in some markets at least. So that's been a fantastic win, which I'm really, really happy about. I love Zalando. I think it's an amazing company. I think Robert is a fantastic entrepreneur. So I'm very proud of that achievement. And yeah, I mean, there are continuously, obviously, a lot of great brands that we would like to work with. Today, it's a little bit more like we launched in Germany now with Airbnb. Very happy to do that. I think they are amazing. So yeah,
what keeps company? Still, I mean, I understand the Amazon example, but like, what keeps Zalando from doing business with you? Because I imagine your sales pitch to them is, look, we increase your conversion. We make sure that more people that look at stuff actually buy it. It's for them, it's sort of risk-free. I mean, at least that's what it looks like to me. It doesn't matter if they use the credit card or if they use whatever else they use. I mean, unless as long as the transaction, it's good for them. What keeps them from just, you know, integrating you?
Yeah, I think one has to remember that in Europe in particular, in US, when you look at the US market, you see a much higher level of specialization where companies do what they are focusing on. And that's typical for very large markets. In smaller markets, Germany still compared to US is a smaller market. You see a little bit more of like companies doing a lot of things. And if you look at Otto, historically, they had their own invoice business, their own Rechnung business, their own Ratenkauf business. And this was a significant revenue and profit driver for them. So there's still this like tradition that you should, you know, do this yourself, or you should do this in-house. And I think in smaller markets, you see more of that. And it takes a little bit of time before they recognize that, like, yeah, but maybe actually, you know, we should be really good at what we do and let these guys do what they're really good at, right? So I think those have been the reasons why it's been a little bit slower sometimes.
Die Werbung.
Wir machen eine kurze Unterbrechung für unseren Werbepartner Liquid. Viele von euch werden es kennen, das Streben nach Selbstoptimierung und dem ständigen Drang, sich weiterzuentwickeln. Die hohen Anforderungen an sich selbst übertragen sich auch oft auf andere Bereiche des Lebens. Umso spannender ist es, dass viele erfolgreiche Menschen nicht denselben Anspruch bei ihren Finanzen entwickeln. Wer aber kein Anlageprodukt von der Stange, sondern hochwertige, maßgeschneiderte Anlagelösungen und einen persönlichen Ansprechpartner sucht, sollte einmal bei Liquid vorbeischauen. Liquid ist ein moderner Vermögensverwalter auf Family Office Niveau. Spezialisiert darauf, Anlegern einen exklusiven Zugang zu Anlagelösungen zu bieten, die bisher nur Großanlegern zur Verfügung standen. Mit Liquid erhaltet ihr nicht nur Zugang zu erstklassigem Wealth Management, sondern auch zu den weltweit führenden Venture Capital und Private Equity Fonds. Wer sich jetzt eben ertappt gefühlt hat und seine Finanzen weiterentwickeln möchte, bekommt hier seinen Reminder, sich einen Moment Zeit zu nehmen. Alle Infos und ein erstes persönliches Gespräch bekommt ihr auf www.liquid.de/ffwd.
Werbung Ende.
Can I switch to another topic?
Sure.
Two questions. You made headlines recently that you don't want to hire new employees, but use AI to replace them. So it sounds like a nice news, but what's behind this?
Well, first of all, was like, I think that it's critical here that about a year ago exactly, right? We, as many others, I saw ChatGPT on Twitter or X, And I started testing it myself. And I was just like, as many others, blown away. I was like, wow, you know, it feels amazing, right? And after Christmas, when we came back, we contacted Sam Altman at OpenAI. I said to them, look, we would like to be your favorite guinea pig and really be the ones that test and learn everything. And I just really, really encouraged all of our employees to like, please lean into this. Please try what you can do with this technology. Obviously, we have to make sure that we're safe, that we're following the privacy standards, et cetera, et cetera. But like with all of that thing, just like try to explore what we can do with this. And we kicked off, there were over 100 initiatives internally that were kicked off to start explore the value of these software. And it was also actually happened to coincide with some interesting other learnings we had internally about graph databases. We had some internal learnings about documentations and wikis, stuff like that. So it happened to coincide with some other interesting internally development. But what it led us to conclude was that like, wow, I mean, you can actually make this work and you can get it to do a lot of things. And I think a lot of the kind of buzz and discussions, if you follow like the online discussions, like it's inconsistent, it dreams things up, it makes things up, you know, it's not always, et cetera, like, you know, it's not always accurate. But I can tell you, and I'm sure that most people would agree, humans aren't accurate always either. And humans also make things up. So like the point is more like how accurate is it and how qualitative is it compared to a human performing similar tasks, right? So for us, it just became, over the last 12 months, it's become very, very clear that it can do a tremendous amount of things. And as a consequence, we can be less people doing much more things. And at the same point of time, we don't want to do layoffs. It was very, very tough and difficult for everyone involved. I mean, obviously, mostly the people affected, but also for us who had to take those decisions and to part ways with fantastic people. And I just don't want to be there. So what we then decided in October is we stopped recruitment because we said, look, we at Klarna in general as a tech company, people stay here for about 4 or 5 years. So that means that every year, about 15 to 20% of staff moves on. And they're also in huge demand from other companies because having Klarna on your CV is a great thing. So we said, let's just stop recruiting. And as a consequence, it will allow us to become fewer and fewer. And we don't have to do any specific, we don't have to proactively ask people to leave, but it will still allow us to become more efficient.
How many people are you right now?
We've been about 5,000, but we are shrinking now. So I think we'll be 4,000 fairly soon. We've also done some outsourcing. So we are quickly becoming fewer. And that is a target for us. We want to become fewer. We want to make sure that we have much higher revenue per employee, which then also will mean that we will be able to pay more per employee, right? So the ambition is that the investment per employee will go up and will be even more attractive from a salary perspective and compensation perspective, but that at the same point of time, there will be fewer of us.
How will this change the culture of the company? Because when you did the outsourcing, there was also a little bit of conflict. People don't know if it's the right move to go to the partner of this outsourcing. So it will change the culture after high growth years.
For sure. No, I think it has to some degree. I think the outsourcing actually, you have to remember like these people, we had two big partners in the outsourcing. One was Accenture. And so people were offered a job at Accenture. I think most people will say a job at Accenture is pretty attractive. They were offered the same terms that they have today. So there was no change in terms. And then the other one was Foundever, which is a huge customer service company across the world. So those two, you know, I think people, I mean, obviously there's always going to be, I mean, to some degree, I'm happy about it. Like there was some people that said, I don't want to work there. I want to work at Klarna. And I think that obviously is a fantastic sentiment to the culture and the company we've built. But at the same point of time, I think it's long-term the right decision. It's been, you know, an outspoken, we've been tried to be as transparent about this as we can, right? And be open with it internally. That's also why I, you know, this is why I speak about this. I understand that some media then says, oh, look, AI and it's a threat of jobs and so forth. And I agree to that. From a society perspective, I am concerned when it comes to society. Look, you have an amazing AI company in Germany, DeepL, who basically have made the job of translators obsolete. And in Brussels, they employ still about 8,000 people to translate all of the EU documentation. And like those people are 50, 55 maybe on average. They're not going to become YouTube influencers. It's a real problem for them, right? Like it's easy to say there will be new jobs, but like that doesn't mean there will be new jobs for these individuals or that it's easy for them to find new jobs. And I think society has a problem here that it will have to address. But as a company, you have to remember that like the main focus is to bring highest quality product at lowest possible price for your customers. And driving these initiatives and making sure to go through this transformation is critical to make sure that we do that.
Last question, maybe on a macro level. I mean, you've built this European company, you're active in the US, you have Japanese investors, so you know the world. What's your perspective on Europe? Versus the US, versus the rest of the world, how do you see our continent developing?
Well, first of all, I am very much a European at heart because, I have a Polish background. My parents were both Polish, and I was born in Sweden, and then I've spent, as you heard, a lot of time in Germany. As I feel like in Bavaria, I don't know, like maybe the Bavarians would say that's different, but anyways, And I had my Radler and I had my Gasmos and I had my, you know.
Okay, I get so, it.
Yeah. So I think that like, I'm a big European, you know, I believe in Europe. I think I see both strengths and weaknesses in Europe. I see the strengths in Europe when I talk to people like Marcus who runs Bolt. And I look at how, you know, Uber has like, you know, twice the amount of engineers that are sitting in Silicon Valley and are paid, you know, tremendous salaries, and they don't seem to be that productive. They seem to, you know, a little bit like in some of those like jokes that went around about Twitter, how does the work at the tech company look like? You get a little bit of that impression. And then you look at this Estonian company and they're so hardworking and they're so dedicated. And you can see, at least here in Stockholm, how Uber is losing out to Bolt, right? Like Bolt is taking over step by step. And it's not because of some fancy big idea or vision. It's because the quality is better and the price is better. And over time, that makes a difference. And I think there's a lot of really, really solid European companies with very thoughtful cost structure, hard, good work ethics, extremely focused, and in particular in Eastern Europe. And so, like, I think that speaks to a lot of the potential. I think the downside and challenges a little bit more is that we are simply not as friendly and as encouraging to business and to entrepreneurs as they are in the US, right? And we want to regulate more and we want to regulate faster. I'm for it, just to remind everyone, I'm not an anarchist. I believe in regulation. I'm not just like, oh, free markets will solve everything. That's not my idea. But with that said, I think there needs to be smart and wise regulation. And I've been to Brussels too many times and I am concerned. Like the fact that we have a European Union that still hasn't been able to say, you know what, maybe it doesn't make sense every year to take a whole month and move the whole office to a different location just because the country can't agree to the fact that maybe like it's fine that we stay and keep the parliament in one place rather than two places. Like when it, and then also when all of us sense, you know, we send our politicians to the European Union, we send them there with one assignment: bring back as much as possible to our country. And an organization that is built on the concept of everyone trying to grab as much for themselves, rather than built on the concepts, how does working together make us all better off? It's just very difficult to get that organization to achieve something. And so I feel that like there are these things make me concerned for Europe. There's too many lobbying groups in Brussels. There's too much of of these kind of like, let's grab as much for our own country as possible mentality. And I would like to see more real union and like a real more common purpose. And it's difficult because we have different languages, we have local political struggles, et cetera, et cetera. So it's hard to see how that's going to happen. But yeah, but that's what I'm going to be worried.
But at least those are homegrown problems. I mean, if we are, I mean, those seem solvable at least. I mean, they're not structural problems for Europe.
For sure. And I was, you're totally right. And I actually was, I was meeting with one of the best VCs in the world. And
Who's that?
I can't tell you who this was, but I can tell you what he showed me. He showed me this idea that like, if you look at the last, if you kind of ignore all the ups and downs and the noise, and you just look at like decades, right? You go back to like, 2010, 2020, and you look at tech companies, you will see that we've gone from, you know, remember like the tech companies back in 05 when PayPal listed, like you had a $5 billion valuation was like tremendous, right? To your point, right? Now you see these companies worth like $1 trillion or hundreds of billions of dollars, even after the big drop. The point is there's a massive overrepresentation of US companies, as everyone knows, right? But in the last few years, you see more and more European companies coming. And I think it's true that you will see more European companies there. But at the same point of time, what concerns me is that I think somebody showed me this statistic. I hope it's correct. But like 20 years ago, the total GDP of the European Union and the US was the same. Today, US is twice the size of the European Union. And I don't know how much of that is because UK left. But the point is still anyways, that like, you know, you get my point. So like the growth here isn't as strong. And I wish we were a little bit more business friendly in general.
All right, Sebastian, thank you so much for doing this, for sort of coming back to Germany, at least virtually for a second. Hopefully we'll have you back at one of our stages, maybe at an event. Thanks for keeping our European flag up on the global landscape, and thanks for sharing your thoughts. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.